All right, today's December the 7th, 1994, and my name is Rick Bradley, and this tape is for the Society for American Baseball Research's Oral History Committee, and I'm in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and today I'm with Don Gutteridge. Don, back when you played, I found this is kind of interesting. You played with guys, I mean, there was a Dizzy, there was a Ducky, there was a Daffy, there was all kinds of nicknames. Did you ever have a nickname?
No, I've been called a lot of things, but I'm not a nickname, but... No, I didn't have a nickname, except they called me Blackie a lot of the times because of my complexion. I was dark complexion, and I was out in the sun, of course, and got sunburned all the time. They called me Blackie a lot.
Tell me about growing up right here in Pittsburgh. You lived here all your life. Tell me a little bit about growing up, and like what did your dad do for a living, things like that.
Well, I grew up, lived here in Pittsburgh all my life. In fact, my mother and Dad met here and married here, and our family has been here ever since. So our family has spent our complete life right here in Pittsburgh, Kansas. And I have three brothers and a sister, and we all lived here and we all stayed here. Well, a couple of them went out of town for a while for a job, but they've all come back and retired here. So we are probably one of the oldest, really oldest family in Pittsburgh, and I love it here.
What did your dad do for a living?
My dad was a railroad man. He worked on the railroad over here, Kansas Southern Railroad. It runs from Kansas City down to New Orleans. And he worked on that railroad for 51 years. And funny thing, two of my brothers followed him in the railroad business. And my other brother, became a druggist, and did have a drugstore here, and called it Gutteridge Pharmacy. And he lived here all his life, and I lived here. I came back after eighth baseball season. I came back here. I went to school here, through high school, and 2 years in college, and I got a chance to go play baseball, and I just said, well, baseball is what I want to do, so here I go. Mm-hmm. I went to play baseball. But we all came back here, and we're really established family here in Pittsburgh. Fact of the matter is, my father, after he retired, was elected mayor here of Pittsburgh. That's not a big city to be a mayor of, but he was mayor here at one time.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, what's your earliest memories about being interested in baseball?
Yes. As I said before, my dad worked at the railroad, and they had, of course, at that time, every little town around here had a baseball team, and the railroad promoted or sponsored a baseball club, and I was at that time when I first started. I wasn't big enough. I was a mascot. They used to call them mascots, and now they call them bat boys or something. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bat boy for that old railroad team over there. And then gradually I got a little bit older, and when I was a junior in high school, well, they let me start playing with them, and I started playing semi-pro ball, what we call semi-pro ball. And then we had in Pittsburgh, we had what we call a city league. And they started the league at soon after 5 o'clock is all of everybody could get there, because everybody quit work at 5 o'clock and they run out to the ballpark and started playing. And we usually played, sometimes we'd play five or six innings, sometimes we'd play seven, whatever the darkness had let us play. It was a little league here. It had about four teams from different merchants in town sponsored it. And mm-hmm. That's where I got started. And then the railroad, our railroad team was really, going out, was advertising the railroad, of course. They wanted us to go. So on Sundays, Saturdays and Sundays, we'd get on a train and go down anywhere along the railroad, maybe Joplin or north to Kansas City or somewhere, and play the other teams, because each city had a team, the railroad sponsored a team. So we'd go and play that on Saturdays, and that's where I got my turn.
Did you play any high school or American Legion?
No, the funny thing, our high school at that time did not have when I was in high school, we did not have a baseball team. We had football and basketball and track, but they never did have a baseball team. And one time my cousin and I, Ray Mueller, of course, we like to play baseball, and we talked to Coach Notion to making a baseball team. So he said, I can't do very much because there's only one coach in high school, and he had to coach track and everything else. And he said, well, if you'll go out there and I'll help you all I can. And he bought us a mask and catching glove and some balls, and about the third week he was out there, somebody stole all of them. And that was the last of our baseball. We had no more baseball in high school.
What positions did you play growing up?
I always played the infield, third base and second base mostly. And I've always played the infield. I never have played anywhere else except, pickup game or something. But then I was an infielder.
What were the circumstances around how you were assigned professionally?
Well, they had a team over here in Joplin, Missouri, which is 30 miles from here. And they had I believe at that time, it was the old Western Association, they called it. And they had a team there. And they invited me to come over there when I graduated from high school and try out. So I tried out at Joplin, and I didn't make it. There was a fellow over there named Joe Becker, who was a scout at that time, I believe, for the Brooklyn Dodgers, I believe it was. And they released me, and then he saw me play, and I guess he saw me play because I played all around here. And about in, I think, the first part of August in 1932, he called me and he said, Dave, I've got a place for you if you want to go play baseball. And he said, Lincoln, Nebraska. Up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and they needed a third baseman. He said, you tell them you can play third base. I said, I will. And I said, okay, so you go on up there, and I'll call and tell them you're coming. So I got on a train and went up to Lincoln, Nebraska. And Lincoln, at that time, was in the Nebraska State League. And I got there about 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening somewhere. And I didn't know where to go or anything, so I just went to the ballpark, and lo and behold, they were out there, and I told them I was coming, so they said, fine. And 7 o'clock that night, I was in professional. I played my first game. And that's how I got started. Joe Becker was the fellow that scouted me and sent me up there. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about it, at that time, he was with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he said, I don't know what they call it anyway. You're going to belong to the Hartford, Connecticut, and Eastern League. I mean, they farm me out in there. I don't know how they do it. The paperwork was, but and so he said. Then at the end of the season, if you play good, then Hartford's going to buy you. And I said, that's fine. I'll play with the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, so. But during that time, at that time when a lot of leagues busted and the old Eastern League went folded, so this became the property of Lincoln, Nebraska. And it was, and then next year, by the way, you talking something about salaries if you want to, I got $75 a month for a month and a half work up there. That was my first season of baseball.
No signing bonus or anything?
No signing bonus. And then the next year, the league was about to go busted, and it was and Branch Rickey said, well, if you'll, Branch Rickey, the old Cardinals, he was with the Cardinals that time, and I'll give you $2,000 to run the league, but in return I get two players off each team. That's eight players that I'll get, because it was a four-team league at that time. And so they said yes, okay. They decided to do that, so we all really became Cardinal League almost, I guess. And I went back up there, and this everybody in the league, regardless of who you were, you got $50 a month. That was it, period. Then at the Branch Rickey, I had a good year up there that year. The fact of the matter is, I led the league in hitting that year, and I think I believe I hit it in triples. And
yeah, 23 triples.
I had a good year. And I was one of the players that they chose. And I might say, out of the eight players that they chose, I think there were five or six of us that ended up in the major leagues. There was Cotton Pippen, who was the pitcher, and myself, Nelson Potter, Lynn King, and I forget who. No, anyway, there was another one. Right now I can't recall exactly who it was, but that was a pretty good bargain. $2,000, and he got five major league players out of it.
Not bad.
No. Brad Strick, he was a pretty slick operator. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows that. And so that's how I came to play. And then that year I went from there. They sent me then to Houston, Texas. Well, fact of the matter is, they took me down to the Cardinals in spring training. Just, I knew I wasn't going to make the Cardinals, but then they wanted to look at you a little bit, and they sent me back to Houston, Texas. And in Houston, I had a fair year there, and I was, at the end of that year, I went up to they called me at the Cardinals, and that was in 1934. If you remember the 1934, when the Cardinals came from behind and beat them, well, when I went up there, there was three of us was called up there, three rookies, and one of them was Pat Ankeman, the other was Walt Alston, and myself, and Frank Dufresne said, now, at that time they were about six or seven games behind, said, now when somebody senses a pennant, you'll want you to play, but you just sit here and learn and enjoy yourself and help out all you can. And so I said, okay, well, they went on then, and they overtook the Giants, and we never did get to play. I never did get to play, but Walt Alston was he pinch hit one time, and Frankie Frase told me, sent Walston up to hit, and he said, now if he gets on base, I want you to run. Well, Alston struck out, and I never did get to play in 1934. Then in 35, I went back to the St. Louis Cardinals spring training camp, and I thought I might have a chance to really make the club then, but I didn't. They could keep 28 players until the 15th of June, I think it was. Well, they sent me back. I stayed there for a while in 35 and played a little bit. But then I went back to Columbus, Ohio, and so I played there, finished the year in Columbus, Ohio. Then in 1936 again, I went back to the Cardinals, and I thought, this time I'm really going to make it. Well, they didn't quite make it, but then they called me back up. They sent me out for a month, and then called me back in August sometime, in August. Mm-hmm. I forget the dates, but then I finished the 36 season with the Cardinals, and stayed there through 1940.
Mm-hmm. What's your family think of you making baseball a career?
Well, I guess my dad and mother were very supportive of me, and that's what I wanted to do. But that was what they wanted me to do, and dad bought me a good ball glove and a couple of good bats, and I thought I was on my way. But no, they all.
This was was it the throes of the Depression? Or?
Yeah, right in the throes of the Depression. You know, not very many people had work anyway. Yeah. Because of this all happened in 1932, 33, 34. And of course, that was Depression years. You know that.
Yeah.
Funny thing, my other brothers never were athletically minded. I mean, they played a little town ball or something, but they never did. Athletics wasn't nothing. They didn't play basketball or football or anything. Two of them were musicians. They'd rather play horn than with the baseball. But they always come to see me play. But they never enjoyed playing themselves.
What do you remember about the little time that you spent with St. Louis at the end of the 34 season?
That was great. There's a couple of stories too about that they broke me in. That was the Gas House Gang, you know that. And I tell you a couple of incidents about it. In 1934, Pat Ankeman and I were roomed together. We're two rookies, so we roomed together. And that was when they had the World's Fair in Chicago. So Dizzy Dean and Pepper Martin and Paul Dean, they said, we're going to the fair, you come on to go. So of course they're going to show us the World's Fair. Well, that was something. And so we went up there, and they was, I never forget, Dizzy got the one of those where you throw the ball and knock the things off there, and you get the prizes.
Well, milk bottles?
Hit the pop bottles, remember? Knocked the pop bottles all down or something, whatever you do. So he got in there, him and Pepper got in those, and they got knocked in those. I remember those guys begging them, said, "Hey, we're not going to." They won all the prizes, and they're showing us a good time. And I never forget, they had one of those big wheels that you sit in, and then the wheels go round and around, you know, and you turn upside down, you know, and they come. And of course, we'd eaten everything we could eat. And Pepper put us on, they said, "Hey, get on there, you and Pat." And then they will forget. And we got on that thing, and he gave the guy the money. And boy, I got sick as a horse. I said, "Let me off here." No, he said, "No." He just kept giving the guy the money. And the guy, they wouldn't stop. We must have went around there for 30 minutes. And we lost all of our cookies. And I, you know, things like that really, really happened. Then another incident in, we were playing in New York, and we had medicals that play in left field, and a pitcher named Ed Huser was a pitcher, and that was the two characters anyway, I mean, that I'm talking about. And came a ball, and there was a ball hit out the left field, and when he came in after it, Medrick didn't catch it. And Ed Huser thought he should catch it, should have caught it. So he came in and he said something on the bench. He said, "Why in the hell, you Hungarian, why didn't you catch a damn ball?" And he said, "Well, I didn't. None of your damn business. You just, why did they hit it that way?" One thing led to another, they got up and started fighting right in the dugout. And I was sitting pretty close to Frisch. Frisch was just sitting there with his arms folded, letting them go. Frisch didn't understand. I said, "Well, yes, the boys are off again. Somebody stopped them." And Frisch never did get off out of his seat. And boy, that scared the hell out of me, because I didn't, you know, two fighting on that. But then we went ahead and won the ball game. But that's a typical gas house game. And there was a couple of times somebody said that they'd in the shower. I remember one time two or three of them fought in the shower and sliding all over, and I was scared to death. You can imagine me, a hick like me from way down in Kansas, seeing all them big guys like that. So I really got an education. But I'll tell you one thing, they fight among themselves, but you better not jump on into them, because they would whip the devil out of you. Mm-hmm. They were all together. When they got on that ball field, they didn't make mistakes, and they'd beat you. And that's typical of a gas house gang.
You had the Wild Horse.
Of the Osage.
But Ed Reuser had a nickname too, didn't he? Would they call him the Wild Elk of the Wasatch?
Yeah. We had two wild ones. In fact, we had a lot of wild ones. Yeah.
What do you remember about the first game you played in the big leagues? I think that was about 36. They finally let you play.
They finally let me play in 36. That was a good game. I remember the first and second games I played. The first game I played, they called me from Columbus, and I joined them in Pittsburgh. They were playing the Pirates. And I walked into the clubhouse, of course, and I had two pairs of shoes. I had one pair of shoes I worked out in, and a pair of shoes I kept for the game. So I walked in and I put on those old shoes, and Frankie Fish said, "What the hell's the kind of shoes is that?" You know, it was all worn out. I didn't have money enough at that time to buy any very many shoes. So I said, "Yeah, I'll just work." I said, "Well, put the others on. You're playing." Well, that scared me to death. Here I was. Of course, I knew by that time I'd been in spring training with them. I knew Dizzy and Paul and Edwick and DeRocher and you know, the whole gas house gang. And so my name was in the lineup. So I was scared to death, of course. Everybody right-minded be scared. I was scared to death, and the game started, and I remember the first inning, everything was fine. No ball was hit to me. I went, you know, boy, it's all right. Now I'm broke in.
And where were you at? The second, third?
I was at third base. I was playing third base, and then second inning or third inning or some, right after that, after the game got started. I remember a guy named Bill Brubaker hit a ball to me. Well, naturally, I was going to boot it. I fumbled it around, and then I picked up right quick, and that was one error. And I picked up the ball and I threw it. Tried to catch him at first base, and it was too late, of course, but then I overthrew Mize at first base, and that was a second error. And then Pepper Martin, by that time, was playing right field. Well, the ball had crooned off, and he had retrieved the ball, and Brubaker then started from first to come on around to third base, and he finally got the ball to me at third base. This time I caught the ball, and I said, boy, this time I'm not going to drop it. Well, they never did tell me down the minor leagues, the guys kicked that ball out of your hand, they knocked you down or anything they could do. Well, he kicked my glove and my hand, and my glove flew one way and the ball flew another, and he cut my arm, and I said, well, three errors and one ball on one game, and that was quite a game. But after that, then I think I ended up getting a couple of base hits out of five times at bat. But that was really my first game, you can't forget things like that. Mm-hmm. But then the second game, then the next day we went over to Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, we played a doubleheader. And I had a real good day that day. I think if I'm not mistaken, I hit an inside the park home run, and I stole home twice. And I had a real good day. I said, nothing else can happen after happening the first game. So I really had a good day. And the rest of that year, I hit 321 or something like that.
319, yeah.
318 the rest of the year. Yeah. And I had a good year that year. I mean, the rest of the year was fine because I said, well, this is where I belong. I'm going to stay here. So
then you had it made, huh?
I thought I had it made.
How about the next year, 37? A lot happened there.
Yeah.
Both Deans and Medwick got in a fight with a couple of reporters. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. down in Tampa, Florida, in spring training.
Yeah.
Yes. Excuse me. In spring training at the old hotel called the Tampa Terrace Hotel. And evidently, there was a reporter from New York who had written something about Dizzy's wife.
Yeah. Jack Miley.
Jack Miley. And after we had played the Reds, because the Reds at that time were training in Tampa. And so we went back to the hotel to dress, and Miley came in, and we just got off the bus from the ballpark, and we all met there, and Dizzy hollered at him, said something about so-and-so, you write my wife, and then, well, things materialized a little bit, and they got me scrubbed, Of course, all of you jump on one of us, right? You got all of us. And fact of the matter is, they started the swing or something. Medwick, I believe, the one that jumped in, of course, and helped Dizzy. And well, we all jumped in, helped Dizzy. And I know that Medwick hit Miley, and then a writer from Chicago,
Irv,
yeah.
I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name. It's K-U-P-C-I-N-E-T. Yeah.
Knopsy, something like that anyway. And he was Miley. I mean, he was going to help Miley.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe whacked him too. And I know the one thing that he knocked him down in the scramble. He had fell down, and this lamp had hit this Irv, it kind of scratched his head. And so later on, he said that Medwick did it. It didn't. He knocked him. I mean, when he fell in his lap, hit him, because I was in the middle of it too. I don't know why, but you know, Dizzy has a record of starting fights, and then we rest of us pushed him back. So we won. If Dizzy get hurt, well, we were in ball games.
Yeah.
If Dizzy and Paul got hurt, we were in trouble. So Dizzy would start the fight, and we'd push him aside, and then we'd jump in and do his fighting for him. I said one time, I think I was in four or five fights, six fights probably, with Dizzy Dean, He hasn't swung a blower, got hit yet, and I got hit in every damn one of them.
Medwick was not the guy to be fighting with. He was fairly strong.
He was strong, yes. Medwick was...
And really, he had a temper, too?
Oh, yeah, he tempered. Medwick, truthfully, Medwick was mean. I mean, because he was just mean. Medwick was no... Well, of course, Pepper, too. Pepper loved... Pepper just... That was in his glory. Pepper could just fight or wrestle or something. He and Pepper and Dizzy was always wrestling and everything. And Frisch always got after him for fighting. Wrestling. They weren't fighting. They were the best of buddies. They were really. But they would always tease one another. They'd always pull tricks on one another.
Yeah.
And I tell you, too, one another story about Pepper one time in, I don't know, 36, 37, sometime. I remember we having a meeting, and Frisch was was giving us a devil about we wasn't hustling, we wasn't doing this, and Frisch could really eat you out. He was very strong with those words. You know what I mean? He could tell you about your Sunday school class and everything. And anyway, he was raving on about us, and Pepper jumped up to held up his hand like a little boy at school. And he said, and finally Frisch said, "What do you want, Johnny?" He called him Johnny. Pepper, he called Johnny, Pepper Martin, Johnny all the time. Johnny, he said, "You know, Frank," he said, "you can't win the Kentucky Derby with a bunch of mules. You've got a lot of asses here. And so we just haven't got the ability to play." That broke up the meeting. Well, go back to Dizzy and Paul, and they played tricks all around there. I remember one time that Dizzy... came in and got Pepper's mail, and he had a lot of tacks. And he did, at that time, the old ballpark in St. Louis, we had wooden floors and wooden lockers, not the modern things they got now. And Dizzy took a hammer and these tacks and tacked his mail, put about 20 tacks in his mail, mailed it to the floor. Well, of course, Pepper tried to get it up, tore it all to pieces. He laughed. He thought that was fun. Well, the next day, Pepper Martin came with he had a hammer and a nail. And he took two nails and it right down through Pepper, about Dizzy's instep of his shoe, and nailed those things clear down to the big 6-penny nail clear down through the floor. Dizzy couldn't get his shoe up. I mean, things like that happened all the time, and it was fun. It was no telling what could happen. I know Dizzy, and unlucky, I was, unluckily, my locker was next to Dizzy's.
Uh-huh.
Just because I was rookie, I was the only one, nobody else wanted to be there.
I see.
And Dizzy would reach over and he'd get one of my sweatshirts and put it on, and he thought anything there belonged to him, but by the same token, maybe the next day he'd buy me a new sweatshirt. I mean, I enjoyed every bit of it with Pepper, and I followed him around like a little puppy followed around, because I really enjoyed it playing with him, and I enjoyed playing with him, and I enjoyed their antics off the field too.
Tell me about the game of the century, the one between the Giants and the Cardinals that got out of hand.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what happened. There was a new rule came out that when a pitcher come set with a man on base, he had to come set for a second. I mean, had to definitely hesitate. Well, Dizzy had a habit of just starting to pitch and pitching and not giving the runner a chance. And they warned him about it. They warned him about it two or three times. And of course, I guess one thing that Dizzy never had enough guys on base. He ever had to do that. You know, what very many got on base for Dizzy. But anyway, and we were playing in St. Louis, and the Giants there, and Carl Hubbell and Dizzy Dean was going to pitch. So you know the crowd was there. It was a big build-up.
Yeah, Hubbell was in the middle of his 24-game winning streak.
Yeah, that's right. So you know what a crowd it was and everything. And it so happened that Dizzy had a man on second base, I think a man on first and second, I think. And Dizzy came, Dizzy was pitching, and they warned him before, and George Barr was the umpire, and he came down and didn't stop. Well, the guy hit the ball anyway, fly ball, but he jumped out and called a balk. Well, that put runners on second and third, and the batter hit again. So he hit another fly ball and scored the run. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that run put him ahead. I'm not quite sure about that. It's been too long.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, then Dizzy got mad. He sat on a mound and he wasn't going to pitch anymore and all, you know, typical Dizzy Dean antic. Well, anyway, we finally got the game started again. He got mad. Well, he started throwing at the hitters, the giant hitters. You know, he'd knock them down. He'd really throw it, really got mad at them. Of course, they got a little tired of that. So this time, I think it was Jimmy Ripple.
Yeah.
And he bunted a ball towards first base. He thought Dizzy would make Mize would field a ball and toss it to Dizzy, who was covering first base, and he was going to run up Dizzy's legs and cut him with his spikes. Well, we thought that, and he fouled the first one. We knew what was going to happen the second time because we knew everybody was waiting for it. And DeRocher was playing shortstop, and DeRocher always called me the kid. So he hollered over to me, "Hey, kid, be ready. Let's go over there. Let's get ready." When he bunted the ball, DeRocher and I left. He was playing short, and I left third. We almost beat the runner. We thought very easily that Mize would get in front of Ripple, and we would get in front of Dizzy, and we'd separate them. Well, we didn't count on those guys coming out of the dugout so quick. It was the first base dugout. They were in the first base dugout. I said, but later on, I said, the Cardinals were really slow because it took them a heck of a long time to get from their dugout to first base. Anyway, we got over there, and sure enough, the fight started. We got in front of Dizzy, and the fact of the matter is, DeRocher and I hooked arms to push everybody back, and Mize was in front of Ripple. So, but we didn't count on those other 20 guys coming out of that dugout, and boy, that fight started. And they were fighting that. And to this day, I don't know, I'm not sure who hit me. I got hit in the eye, and I'm telling you, he floored me. When I woke up, there was spikes all around. I was laying in the ground, and I said one time, I think the guy hit me so hard that my feet flew up, my head stayed the same for a minute, and my head flew up, and I lit on my head. But anyway, that was a big fight. I got out of there, and I had a black eye. You could almost hang your hat on that black eye. It was sticking out there so much. But it was really a big fight. And the funny part of it was the second part of the whole thing that nobody thinks too much. Pepper Martin loved it. He liked to fight anyway. And they said that Pepper would run into the – he came in from right field. And he would get somebody and give him a flip, like pinwheel going out towards second base, and you stay there, and he'd go up and get somebody. He had about four or five of them lined up out there in back. And so, of course, Pepper was a great friend of mine. The thing quieted down, and everything quieted down, so we all back in the dugout, and the umpires would wait, just get back in your dugout till we get things straightened out. So Pepper come in laughing. Boy, he had fun. And he looked at me and said, "Who the hell hit you, kid?" I said, "I don't know." So he took out and run right to the dugout, a giant dugout, said, "Whoever hit that kid, come out of here." He said, "I want to beat the hell out of him." He was mad because he'd hit me in the eye. And he went over to their dugout and challenged the whole dugout with him. But we settled it. And my eye was black. And I really had a shiner.
You thought it was Luciazzo?
Yes, I did. But later on,
Bartel said in his book, he thought it was, I want to get the pronunciation right, was Adolf Luque?
Luque, they call
Luque?
It. Yeah, Adolf Luque from, he's a Cuban.
Yeah, he was a coach.
Yeah, coach. He was a coach, yeah. Let everybody told me. Later on, because last time I remember, Chioza was coming, and I thought it was Chioza.
Mm-hmm.
Lou told me later on in Memphis, I'm in Memphis, you know, a couple of years later.
Yeah.
He said, "Don, I didn't hit you." He said, I didn't. Well, I knew he didn't. I mean, I didn't, because he was a mild-mannered guy. I took it as truth, and several of them told me it was Lukey that hit me.
But this Lukey was nuts, didn't he? I mean, Burgess Whitehead said that even the Giants were afraid of him.
That's right.
He carried brass knuckles, a switchblade, and a gun.
He carried a switchblade. I saw the knuckles, the brass knuckles. He carried them. He was a rough character.
Mm-hmm.
I know how rough he was. I found out how rough he was.
Now, didn't something happen in Diz's next start? Didn't he go from one extreme to the other? Now he went into, he held the ball.
Oh, yeah. He was going to make up for it. Yeah. He held the ball. Then they called, umpire finally called it. And they had a terrible time. He said, you said to stop, and I'm going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
He was just
a big kid, right?
Dizzy never grew up.
Mm-hmm.
He never grew up.
Tell me about the All-Star game in 37 and what happened to Diz.
I wasn't at the All-Star game, but I know what happened.
Yeah.
The All-Star game was in, I think it was in Washington. And Earl Averill hit Dizzy was pitching and hit a line drive back and hit Dizzy on the foot, on the toe. And it broke his toe. Well, then he couldn't pitch for several days, and he said it still hurt. And we got up in Boston, the old Boston Braves, and Dizzy, and I think Frisch didn't think that Dizzy hurt as bad as he was hurt. And he told Dizzy said, I can't pitch. And he said, yes, you got to pitch, because this game's important, you're going to pitch. So Dizzy went out and pitched, and I think what happened, he hurt his toe, and instead of a pitcher, had to push off his front foot. Well, Dizzy was hurting him, so he kind of threw off his heel. He kind of turned his toe up and threw off his heel, and consequently hurt his arm. I mean, the reaction was they hurt his arm, and that's where Dizzy it happened in Boston, the old Boston Braves Park, and I was there. I know that.
Was there, did Breeden or Ricky put any... Because the Cardinals are in a pennant race again in 37.
Yes,
they put any pressure on him to maybe come back too soon?
Yeah, that was the whole thing, yes. Yes, very definitely. They put the pressure on him to come back and pitch, because we were in pennant race. And that was, I think that was a whole problem. If Dizzy would not have done that, I think he would have pitched a lot longer. But that really hurt. Dizzy never was the Dizzy he was before. You could tell he wasn't as fast. His control wasn't good. He just wasn't a good pitcher.
Yeah. But he had kind of, with regards to trying to make his salary a little bit better, he had cried wolf about his arm.
Yeah, yeah.
So many times before, I guess that they didn't take him seriously then.
That's the whole thing that they did, because every time he wanted a raid or something, well, I got a sore arm, I can't pitch. Well, that was his and like the little boy, the hollered wolf, too much, and they didn't believe him.
What kind of, just the last question about 37, tell me about the year that Medwick had.
Oh, that Medwick could do no wrong. I tell you, Medwick was, at that year, I think he was as good a hitter as I've ever seen that year. I seen Medwick at that time, he was a wild swinger and had power. He had talking about wrist and power, he could hit a ball anywhere. I mean, out of any park, and the balls he hit on the line were shots. He was a good hitter, and I've seen Medwick hit balls off the bounce. I saw him hit one time. The pitcher threw one that bounced, and he's going to swing. He made up his mind he's going to swing. He hit the ball. I seen him hit the balls higher and swing it when the ball was over his head. I've seen him hit. He could hit ball any place, and I think that it was a fantastic year, and every ball he hit that year seemed to me like every ball he hit was a line drive. He didn't hit any flukes. He really hit the ball, and Medwick was a good hitter. I think he won the Triple Crown.
Triple Crown in 37.
He did a lot. That was a good year. Excuse me. Myers had a good year that year too. And Medwick kind of overshadowed Mize. Mize, normally, everybody would we got a lot of publicity with Medved hitting ahead of him or hitting behind him. You always go for the big guy, you know. Mm-hmm. And Myers really had a good year that year too. Myers was a good hitter. And but that was a fantastic year for Joe. And he did everything right. I mean, he had a lot of assists from the outfield. He did everything. That was his year. That was the year he shone.
I think the following year, we were talking about Ricky and shyster isn't the word I want to use. Yeah, but you understand. When they traded Dizzy the following April,
yes.
And he got quite a bit in return for a guy that had nothing left.
That's right. Oh, yes. He got Davis, Steinbach. Somebody will have to help me on the rest of them.
Yeah, but it was five players.
I think it was
$200,000 or something.
$200,000, and he talked Wrigley into notion that Dizzy could still pitch. Of course, like, he was a good horse trader.
Yeah.
Dizzy just couldn't pitch anymore. In spring training that next year, all the players knew that Dizzy couldn't. I mean, we seen it ourselves, and it really is. I don't know. It was a shame. Truthfully, we all felt so badly for him because really it wasn't his fault. And we didn't feel it was his fault that he got the sore arm in the first place, because we always kind of knew that Dizzy couldn't pitch. And it was really a bad situation. We all hated seeing him go. And can I tell you now a story about it when he pitched against us in Chicago after
sure.
that? Paul, I mean, Dizzy and Pepper were always buddies. I mean, they were really, really buddy, and they really loved one another. And so we went up to Chicago, and we big to do, you know. Dizzy's going to pitch against the Cardinals and all this. And the crowd came, you know, the whole thing hipped up. And Pepper told Frankie Frisch, I heard him tell him, I can't play today. I got a sore stomach. I can't play today. He said, Johnny, you know that you're going to play today, because the only reason you don't want to play is because you don't want to hit against this. that was right, too. He didn't want to hit. He said, yeah, but Frankie said, somebody liable to kill him out there. I said, he just can't pitch no more. I'm liable to hit him and kill him.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Pepper really did hit a lot of balls through the mound. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was normally. So, sure enough, that he said, no, you're going to play. So he went up there and unluckily, Pepper hit a ball, hit it right back to Diz, and hit Diz in the belly. I mean, you know, stopped the ball, but it hit. And Pepper, instead of Pepper running to first base, he ran out to see if Diz was hurt.
Mm.
That's the God's truth. And that did. And it this shows it. Dizzy and Paul were really, Dizzy and Pepper were really great, great, great friends.
Mm-hmm.
Great friends.
Talk about Pepper. Something happened that year. There was a game against the Braves, and Casey was managing the Braves. And Pepper almost always played the outfield, but once in a while they stuck him in third, and I guess he hated to play third base.
That, yes.
And Casey told his gang to bunt on Pepper.
Pepper, he said, I was playing third base, and something happened, and I couldn't play it. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, they put Pepper in. And Casey would give the sign for him to bunt. The second guy that bunted, I forgot it was Deb Garms, maybe. I don't know who it was. Anyway. And Pepper picked up the ball. Instead of throwing it to first base, he hit the guy in the back with the ball. He said, now, bunt some more, will you? They didn't bunt anymore. Yeah, that was true.
what do you remember? We have a couple more minutes on this set of tape. But what do you remember about the Dodgers signing Ruth as a coach that year?
The Yankees and the Cardinals, when I was with the Cardinals and the Yankees, they both of them trained in St. Petersburg, and so I got acquainted. I mean, we played against each other and seen each other out in spring training, and I didn't think much about that. I know that they wanted, Babe Ruth wanted to manage, and nobody gave him a job because I think some of them told him he couldn't handle himself. He couldn't.
And you handled 28 guys.
And so that happened, and so he came and they signed him as a coach, I believe. And then he left there. Then he went. Then Babe Ruth go over there, and then he went to the old Boston Braves. After that,
I want to say he was with the. You mean as a player?
As a player, no. As a player coach.
I think he was with the Braves in 35, and he just came back as a
35,
coach.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, yeah. Was he just used as a sideshow, batting practice type?
That's right. Just somebody come in to see the great Babe Ruth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't. I got that mixed up. 35 is right when he signed with the Braves. Then he went back. With Brooke, I mean, as coach, I think coach and batting practice hitter, mm-hmm. You know, just as a
bring people into the park,
as a show, a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm.
Did you get? Did you talk to him much? Did you get to know him very
no,
well?
No, I didn't know him very well. Of course, I talked to him. You know, on the field, and I'd say hi, babe, how you doing, or maybe conversation. But I never got to actually. Know him very well.
He didn't call you a kid by chance.
No, no. I think he called everybody the kid, didn't he?
Yeah. He did. Was there a game in August? There was a doubleheader against Brooklyn, and Larry McPhail used yellow baseballs.
Yeah, yes, there was two times against Larry McPhail, as I remember. The Cardinals were playing the Dodgers. That was when, you know, McPhail was a big, you know, he did everything to draw the crowd, which is very good. He had lot of invocations and yellow baseballs, and they were so slick, you know, they never, you couldn't throw them. I mean, they were just
the dye was coming off on your hands.
Dye and it wasn't very stubborn. I think that was a night game, wasn't it?
That I don't remember that, but
I think it was a night game that he tried to. It didn't.
Yeah, because you know, I guess with 30 years later, Charlie Finley tried orange baseball, and they laughed at him. But this had been going on.
Yeah, the previous. I mean, I think Charlie kind of may have gotten the idea from McPhail.
About a month later, they got rid of Frankie Frisch.
Yeah,
they fired him. What do you think of Frisch as a manager? You two get along with him?
Yes, Frisch. You know, Frisch was a harsh, you know, talker. I mean, he was very brisk and. But Frisch was very good to me. And I tell you one thing about Frisch, he was manager, of course, when I went up there. And this day I went up there, and one time we were playing, this happened back in 36. I'll go back a little bit.
Okay.
And we were playing in Boston Braves, and I was playing. And I think it's 36 or 37 anyway, whatever it was. I had an old glove that it was pathetic looking old glove, and I wore it. I liked it. And one day, you know, when we traveled, we used to travel in trunks, and they put the trunks in the middle of things. And, you know, when you get through playing, you put all your stuff in the trunks and it hauled it. Well, these trunks lay in there, and we had lost this ball game in the Braves Park. And somewhere I was on base at the time. Of course, everybody when the game's over there, they pick everything up and take it inside. And if your gloves are there, they throw them on and pick it up. And Frisch was giving us the devil. He was just eating us up. And so, somebody bought my glove and I laid it on one of these trunks. And he walked along there and said, "Who the hell's glove is this? That old looking thing." And he picked that thing up and he gave it a sling and it went right through the window, out on the street, like, I mean, our dugout was next to the street. And my God, that was my glove. And I didn't claim it. But I told the clubhouse boy, I said, "Go get that glove. Go get that glove." The thing was, it was so bad, that there was kids playing out in the street and they didn't even pick it up. The kid went out. they kids out there, that clubhouse boy went out there and got my glove and brought it back. And next day he said, "Was that your glove?" He called me next morning at the Kenmore Hotel. And he called me up into his room. And I thought, "Oh boy, this is it." You know, I was scared to death.
Yeah.
And he said, "Was that your glove?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You can get you another glove." I said, "Here." Well, he traveled with a trunk. He went, I remember he ripped that trunk and pulled out a brand new Spalding green glove. He was Spalding. He'd signed with Spalding. Mm-hmm. And he had some gloves on. He said, "Here, you break this glove in and you use this glove." Don't with the, he said, after this, he'd give me a real lecture about having good tools. He said, "A carpenter's got a good hammer and a good saw." He said, "You need good tools. You get your good shoes and good glove. That's where you play." And then we'll forget that. He gave me that glove and pat me on the back and said, "Now you go after it." And I did.
Mm-hmm. How'd Leo and Frankie get along? Those two like each other?
Well, no, they hated each other. No, Frankie and Leo didn't see eye to eye. I think Leo had ambitions of wanting to manage, and I think Frisch realized that, and I think that's why they didn't get along. But both of them treated me great. In fact, I'll tell you a story about two of them. I was went up to we was playing in Chicago Cup. I never will forget Chicago. And Dizzy was pitching. Well, Dizzy, you know, Dizzy gets the ball, he threw it. You know, I mean, he spent no time whatsoever. I mean, he pitched. He got the ball in his hand and he threw it. Well, it so happened that there was an out made. You know how the third baseman jumps up and the ball was thrown around, and I was up close to the mound, I tossed the ball to Dizzy. Well, he was on the mound and Frank Demery was up. And so then I started back to third base. And I just barely got back to third base and that ball went by me, a line drive, hit by me. I wasn't even ready. I just turned around just enough to see it and duck. And I came in and Priest gave me hell. He met me at the thing. And DeRocher said, "Hey, wait a minute, you Dutch son of a gun. Don't blame that kid." He said, "Blame that Dizzy. We wasn't even ready to play." He said, "Diz threw that damn ball before it." So he took my part. I thought that really mm-hmm. helped me with the Frisch to give me hell, but DeRocher wasn't gonna stand by it. He was gonna give me he was taking my part. Another thing about DeRocher that always impressed me, in 1944 I was then with the Browns and he was managing, I think at that, well, he was with Brooklyn, I think. Anyway, he came and I was on the American League side and he was sitting back of the dugout on the Cardinals side. He and Joe Medrick got up and came around over there and called me out of the dugout and congratulated me and wished me luck. And then went back and said, and I thought that was, to me, that was the greatest thing, because here they came and told me, I mean, they came clear all around, made a special effort just to wish me luck and mm-hmm. and let me know that they thought about me.
Well, that's nice.
Couple really, that was one of the nicest things that ever happened to me, I think.
Mm-hmm. Just real quick, the Cardinals won it all in 34, but of course you weren't, you had not much to do in 35, no. But 36, 37, 38, they had, the hitters were pretty much the same. I mean, they always had hitters, but they never did win it again, just not enough pitching?
Not enough pitching, and they were just, we played good defense and good hitting, but our pitching just wasn't that good. I think during that time, during 36, 37, 38, 30, I think we finished second and third, out of those 5 years, I think three or four of them, we could have won the pennant. I mean, mm-hmm. we were close enough that we could have won the pennant.
Yeah.
I think then, what was it, what year was it that the Cubs won 22 out of the last 23 games and beat us out? Was that in 38 or 39?
Oh, that was 30.
38.
Well, the Cubs were in the series in 32, 35, and 38. So.
38 was the year. Because we had a chance to win until they won 22 out of the last 23 games or something and beat us.
Mm-hmm.
And that year, we thought we were going to win the pennant.
Mm-hmm. The following year, 39, is it true or not, you almost went to the Leo, I think, was managing the Dodgers then in 39?
Yes.
And you almost went to the Dodgers. He wanted to trade. He wanted to get rid of Lavagetto.
Yeah.
And he wanted you.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I heard that. I mean, of course, you never. At that time, they didn't tell the players much, you know. But I think that happened because I played with him, and he wanted. When I went to Brooklyn, I always had pretty good luck playing in Brooklyn. I mean, I had good days in Brooklyn. And that very well could have been, but I can't verify that.
I meant to ask you this. This is about the fourth or fifth question I should ask, but when you were a kid growing up, did you have a favorite player or a favorite team?
Yes, the Cardinals were my favorite team. Mm-hmm. Pepper Martin was my favorite player. And then when I went to the other league, I mean, when American League, Lou Gehrig was my favorite. But Pepper was all... in 1931, when Pepper went crazy,
mm-hmm.
I was just had finished high school, and my brother and I and another fellow here who played semaphore with me said, "Let's go see the series." I said, "I don't know." He said, "I'll buy you gasoline, and we'll go see the series." I said, "Okay." So Dad, Mom said, "Sure, go ahead." So we went up. We left about 5 o'clock in the evening. That here, we went up to St. Louis, and got in line. About 3 o'clock in the morning, we got in line to get into the bleachers. We didn't have no seats, and to watch Pepper Martin because he was my big favorite. And so they would send these concessionaires were selling a little red pepper on a little ribbon. And tied a red pepper to it, and I bought one of them things for a dollar and tied it on me because I wanted Pepper Martin. That was supposed to be Pepper Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd always been my favorite.
Did you, when you two finally played together, did you tell him that story?
Well, yes, I told him the story. And by the way, he and his wife and my wife became quite friendly. Well, I mean, we still, and she, of course, Pepper's dead, but Mrs. Martin lives in Galveston, Oklahoma, and she called. We have talked.
Mm-hmm.
We are still buddies.
1940 was your last year with the Cardinals.
Yeah.
Something that happened at Crosley Field. There was a flood at Crosley Field, and the game was postponed.
Yes, yes.
And then when it was replayed like 3 weeks later, yeah. Nobody bothered to tell the league office, and no umpires showed up.
Yeah. It was. Fact of the matter, when old Crosley Field, and when it get too much water, and we went out to that fire, and actually, they said, "We're going to start playing, although we know the flood's coming up." So we started and dug out, and later in the game, they took the benches out of the club, out of the gut, and set us out on the field, and there was water coming up in the dugout. That's right. And then we finally finished the game. Then, of course, the next day, they showed pictures of a guy rowing a boat over the fence, over the fence at Crosley Field, in that field. I remember seeing that picture.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were gone by the time. And then they did. Nobody played. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they took a player from each side. And I think
Warnicke
was our umpire. And
I can't remember who there was, but I guess Larry Goetz eventually showed up. He lived in town.
Yeah, because he lived. I mean, they called him or something. And he lived. I think he lived just out of Cincinnati. It was his home, and he was hunting. They called him and told him to go over. Things happen.
Mm-hmm. You didn't play much in 1940. You only got into 69 games. What was the reason there?
Well, Billy Southworth became manager, and evidently he didn't think that I was doing the job, and I just didn't get to play very much. I was very unhappy about the whole thing, and I don't know why. I mean, but I had a fair year in 39, and yet I didn't get to play very much, very very little in 1940, and then they sent me to Sacramento in 1941.
Mm-hmm. What was the deal that happened in 1940 between Bob Bowman and Medwick after the Cardinals had sent Medwick over to Brooklyn?
Yeah, they Medwick and Bowman never did. I mean, they weren't friends. Let's put it that way. And so when they came there and they was talking about it, and they're going to knock Medwick down, and you know, well, Bowman was pitching, and I don't know, to this day, I don't know if he actually threw at him, or if ball just got away, or if Medwick was ducking, you know, was charging into the ball, or what. I can't say, but he hit Medwick, and it meant pretty hard. In fact, Medwick, they sent him to the hospital after a concussion, I mean, like they always do. But after that, Medwick, that blow, Medwick never did really regain his. But I doubt very much if he actually wanted to hurt Medwick. He probably wanted to throw close to him and knock him down.
There was a rumor or something that Bowman had been on the elevator the night before with Medwick and Leo, and they'd gotten into an argument.
They said that. I can't remember. But yes, I heard that same story, but I cannot verify it.
And then McPhail wanted Bowman thrown out of baseball.
Yeah, no, he wanted. Oh yeah, but that was a big thing for McPhail, because you know McPhail, he used any opportunity to get a little publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what that was, I don't think that was very serious.
This isn't something that happened in 1940. But kind of the whole time you're in St. Louis, I got to ask you, who was I'm gonna get her name right. Who was Mary Ott?
Mary, she was our chief rooter. She came to say, she never missed a ball game. And she was like that lady they had in Brooklyn, but she was our, Mary Ott was ours. And she had a holler, she had a voice. I'm telling you, you could hear.
They called her the horse lady?
Clear downtown. She'd whinny like a horse. Yeah, you'd do something, you'd, you know. And they call her the horse. I mean, she had a voice that she would imitate a horse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pretty amusing, eh?
Oh, yeah. She was a rough character, too, yeah. I'll tell you. But she loved the Cardinals. Anything the Cardinals did or any of the players, boy, she was there to help out if she could help out. But she was there again, and she yelled, and she got everybody else yelling, too. She said some things that wasn't too nice to do at the time.
For those who are... never got to see you play, go ahead and just briefly describe your hitting stance.
Well, when I first went up to the Cardinals, my first years at the Cardinals, I was an inside hitter. I mean, I like the ball inside. I mean, because I get around the ball, and I stood fairly close to the base, and I had a compact, a real good compact swing, and I hit the ball hard. I never was a home run hitter, so to speak. But I hit a lot of balls hard between the outfields. I mean, that was I was a line drive hitter. And I had power. I could hit a ball hard a long ways. And that's why, luckily for me, I could run. I was very fast on my feet. And I could run, and I hit a ball between the outfield. I hit a lot of doubles and triples. That's why I hit a lot of doubles and triples. But I had power, and I had really strength. And then continued with my hits. I hit good. I didn't strike out a whole lot. I met the ball. I met the ball. Then later on, when I went over in American League, I had lost. I got a little older, of course, and I lost some of my power. And I hit further up in the lineup, and they told me that what they wanted me to do, Sewell wanted me to do when I came over back in the American League. He said, forget about the home runs. I want you on base. I want to use your speed on the bases. And I want you to be on base for somebody else to drive you in. And so I changed my batting a little bit. I used to be a pull hitter. I hit a lot of balls to the left field. I was right-hand hitter. And then after I came over to the American League, I started what they call scattering the ball. I mean, I tried to hit the ball to right field or just any way I could do to get on base. And that's why I changed. That's why I didn't hit many extra base hits, because I changed my style of hitting to conform with, because that's what they want me to do. And I could stay in the league doing that. Well, I would be able to do it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody that you copied?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I think I just started hitting. I mean, I don't think I really copied anybody in my hitting stance.
What kind of a fielder would you consider yourself?
I feel very good. I was a very good fielder. I think one year of the Cardinals, I think I led the league in fewest errors. I think, in one year at third base, I believe it. I made very few errors, but I was a little bit wild in my throwing, especially from third base. But in second base, I didn't, because I didn't have that much. But I was a good, I always was a good fielder. I could always field the ball. And I could always throw. I had a good arm, good legs, and a big mouth.
I know you said you were pretty fast. Were you ever timed going from home to
no,
first?
No. At that time, we didn't time. But I'll tell you one thing. What did happen, I believe it was in 1938. Yes, it was 38. The National League had a series of races to see who was on. McPhail promoted this. He said there was eight clubs, and the two clubs would play against each other. They would run a race, and the winners of that race would eventually come to Brooklyn when we were playing in Brooklyn, and it was all about to see who was the fastest man in the National League. Well, we played, I ran against Chicago was my first. I beat Cabrera and what's the little outfielder's name? Another outfielder, I forget who it was. I won the race. And then we all ended up in there was eight of us that ran a race in Brooklyn one night. And we ran from right field across to left field. It was supposed to be closer to 100 yards as we could get. I mean, they could make it. And I won that race. And I was declared the fastest man in the National League in 1938. And I tell you a little story to that too. I never was in the training room. I mean, and Doc Weaver called me before that game. I was going to run the race before the game. Come here, I want to talk to you. He said, take off your shoes. I want to rub your feet. I said, what do you mean, rub your feet? Never rubbed my feet before. He said, I bet $20 on you. So he bet $20 on me. And I mean, I did. And I never, Lon Warnicke was my roommate. And he said, you better run like hell tonight. I said, why? He said, well, because he said, I've taken our mule money and bet it on you. And so I said, hey, what is it? Come to find out that Leo DeRocher then was the manager of Brooklyn, and he bet that I would beat Ernie Coy. Ernie Coy was his runner, and I was he won a bet against his own, and some of his players kind of resented that a little bit, but he did. I don't know if he acted better, but he said he did.
Well, he knew you, so.
He knew I could run. And anyway, I run that race against Ernie Coy, Herschel Martin. I'm not sure. I forgot who all was in, but I know we finished 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. And I was declared the fastest man in National League. And the good part about it, they gave me $200. That was more money than I was making all the time.
What happened in 41? How did you wind up with Sacramento for that 1 year? And then tell me how you went from Sacramento to the Browns.
Okay, I told you before that Pepper Martin was a good friend of ours. Pepper and Ruby was a good friend of Helen's and mine. And so they sent me out to Sacramento. I mean, they sent me out after the 40 season. Southward didn't want me, so I was supposed to go to Sacramento. Well, I said, no, I'm quitting. I'm not going to play in the minor league. I'm going to get a job, and that's going to be it. I'm going to quit. Well, Pepper Martin was named manager of Sacramento. So he and Ruby come up from Oklahoma up here one day, and he said, come and visit you. He come and told me, he said, now, I'm going out there to manage, and I need you to help me. Really, I need your help, and I want you to help me. And he said, if you'll just come out there for 1 year and help me for the first year to manage this club and be my kind of assistant, like, and player coach or whatever. Anyway, he said, I'll really appreciate it. So Helen said, my wife said, well, let's just go out there with him for 1 year and let's just make it a nice, easy year. You can go out and play a year. We'll spend a year in California. Then come back and we'll find a job and go to work. Well, I did. And I had a good year out there. I led the league in stolen bases, and I led the league in two or three different. I had a good year. And we had a good year. Fact of the matter is, we played out there, and Pepper, he only had 16 players. They didn't give him enough players, really. And Pepper's idea was to run. Run, hit and run, and just run and go crazy. Do
just like he played.
He said, just like he played. Do the unexpected. Do something that the other opposition don't want you to do. I mean, don't expect you to do. But with two strikes on you, do anything you want to. Well, he was a wild, wild manager. And so he said, now I'll tell you what, he said, anything happens, you argue with the umpire because I'm going to play out there. He had a player coach. He was going to play right field. You argue until I get up there. so that was the year. That's how I went out to Sacramento, and then I had a good year. And I told him I was going to quit. And Cardinals still owned me because they just wound me out. And so that time the Browns came over there. They were they walked down the hall, I guess. They said, "If you'll let us have Gutteridge," and that time, of course, some of the players were starting to go into the service. Mm-hmm. And so they said, okay, well, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they give them $500 for the option of letting me come to spring training if you make it, and then they give me $250 more if I made it. So they sold me for $750. And I went to spring training with Luke Sewell, and Luke said to me, he said, "I need a second baseman. I've been playing third base. I need a second baseman." He said, "I think you can play second base, and I want you to play second base. But one thing about it, I'm not going to let anybody fool with you. You go play, you go do what you want. I mean, learn how to do it. You do your own. If you want to know anything, you come to me. My coaches, nobody's supposed to bother you. Whatever you do, just learn yourself. Just do it yourself." And he said, "But I suggest that you go to talk to the other second basemen and somebody that you know." Well, I knew Bobby Doerr, and I knew Joe Gordon and a couple of guys. So in spring training, we'd play him in spring training, and I'd go early. I'd go out and talk to me. "How do you do this? What is your idea of this?" And they were very helpful. They tried to teach me and tell me, and we'd talk together, both of them did. And consequently, then I was turned out to be the second baseman for St. Louis Browns.
Didn't Ricky make a statement that he didn't think he could play
second? Right. That's right. He said he cannot play second base. Ricky said two things that burned me a little bit. He said that I was not a winning type ball player. And yet I had played on every ball club. Every ball club I ever played on was finished in the first division. I never finished the last division yet. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "I'll never play second base." Well, that burned me up a little bit too. And so Luke Sewell said he'll play second base for me. And Luke, I'll say that for Luke, he said, you know, "You're the second baseman. Don't worry about anything. Just we're going to start the season, and yet that's it." And I did. I had to work like the devil, and I got to be a pretty good second baseman.
Mm-hmm. Well, just real quick, we'll go over the first 2 years of the Browns, 42 and 43. Now, you're over with the Browns now at 42, and here it turns out that all the years you were with the Cardinals, they came close, never got into 42. They're in the series.
They're in the series, that's right. It was, but then, you know, I was glad for those guys because I knew all of them, and I was glad that they won. But in 42 and 43, the Browns had never finished in the first division. Mm-hmm. And I think in 42, in the first division. I know
finished third.
Yeah. 42. And the funny thing, the Browns, and at that time they had a meeting to give up, you know, how many shares you're going to get because you got a share of the World Series. And somebody said to me, "Well, how do you do? You know,
they had no idea
how to do it. So really, I wasn't counting anything, but they said, "You've done it before. Why don't you tell us how to go about it?" Mm-hmm. So I told them, you know, what the other clubs have done, how they've got. And to me, that was real funny to think that here's the players that some of them have played 5, 6, 10 years and never had a chance to get in a World Series money. Hmm. And so that we give them the idea, hey, this is pretty good. So we turned out to be a pretty good club, of course, thanks to Sewell. And,
they didn't have batting helmets in those days, but it was right around that time, I think, that somebody made a helmet liner.
They made a helmet liner.
Uh-huh.
They made a helmet liner, and I believe it was Ricky. And when he was in Pittsburgh at that time?
No, Rick was in Pittsburgh in the 50s.
50, well, anyway, it seemed, that's right, somebody made a liner.
Yeah, Spalding or somebody,
yes. Yeah, somebody made a liner. Oh, that's right, too, because Ricky made the back, he had that whole helmet, didn't he?
Yeah, Ricky.
I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But anyway, yeah, they made liners for it.
Anybody use one?
I used one. I think this just notoriety. But I hit it. I did. All of us, I think all the ball players resented the fact that we had to have protection. We couldn't take, we were proud. Mm-hmm. We could take care of ourselves. We didn't want any extra things. Ball players, there's a difference between ball players today and ball players then. Ball players then, they was proud of their work. They was proud of what they did. They was pride to, had pride in their work, and they didn't use any extra thing. They said we're it, period. And they didn't take those helmets very good. Mm-hmm.
Had you ever been either before or since then? Had you ever been beamed?
Oh yes. I think I got hit one time down in the Texas League way back.